Welcome along to Unbelievable. It's Saturday afternoon. I'm Justin Brierley, and this is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate every single Saturday as part of Faith Explored. We're going to have a fantastic debate for you, as ever, on the programme today. But if you want to listen back to the vast archive of past shows, and we've been going now for, 9 years and a bit, so there's lots of shows to listen to. Admittedly, not all of the early ones were made available online, so it's not quite that vast an archive. But nonetheless, lots of shows back there, and you can access them all at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Many people download the podcast week to week. It feels like there's a real family, actually, of Unbelievable listeners, and I do appreciate all of those who get in touch on a regular basis. There are the real regulars that I know I'm going to hear from almost every week, but it's also nice to hear from new listeners too. So if you want to get in touch with the programme today, do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk or get in touch via our social media at UnbelievableJB to follow me on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow the Facebook page of the show. All the links and more available from premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. We'll be hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's programme. And last week we were talking about, does humanism need God? Quite a lot of response to that. So look forward to reading out some of that a little later on in the programme. And don't forget, if you're continuing here on Premier Christian Radio after Unbelievable, the profile follows on soon after between 4 and 5, when Maria Rodriguez speaks to two extraordinary women, Marilyn Skinner, Ugandan missionary, and Vineyard church leader Christy Wimber. All that to look forward to today, but right now let's introduce my guests as we get into today's discussion.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, we're asking, does Christianity pass the outsider test for faith? Now, if that phrase is familiar at any level, it'll be because one of my guests, our atheist guest today, John Loftus, has been on the programme a few times before. And he's well known online as an atheist and for some books which he claims debunk the Christian faith. And the so-called outsider test for faith is something he's formulated, and he believes shows that Christians, if they were to examine their beliefs as sceptically as they treat other belief systems, well, that they would abandon their faith. We're going to be hearing from John and reminding ourselves of exactly what this outsider test for faith involves. One of John's main critics online in recent years has been David Marshall, who's our Christian guest on the programme today. He's a Christian author and thinker based out in China. He's got a great interest in world religions, and his new book, How Christianity Passes the Outsider Test, is a response to John's claims, and he shows that Christianity is unique among world religions in 4 ways. We're going to be getting to some of those, but just briefly, he believes that it does answer 2 of God's promises to Abraham, changes the world along the way. It passes what could be called Aristotle's outsider test for faith and fulfills the deepest traditions in world history, the deepest truths in all world traditions. So there's lots of stuff we're going to be trying to unpack on the programme today as we look at this question of the outsider test for faith. But welcome along, first of all, both to John and to David.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks for having us on.
It's great to have you both on, gentlemen. It's been a long time, David, since we had you on, I think. It seems to me back in the early days of the program, probably. But you've been writing and publishing a lot in the intervening years. And as you're probably less familiar to some of the listeners than John, perhaps we'll start with you. Brief background to you, David, and how you've come to sort of be writing in the area of Christian apologetics, and particularly with regard to Christianity, as it fits within the world religions.
Well, I've been fascinated by other cultures and other religions pretty much all my life. And I've been working in Asia for a big chunk of my adult life also. So when I read John's discussion of the outsider test for faith, I was very interested because for me, it's not just an outsider test. I live in parts of the world that are very far removed from historical Christianity. So it's very interesting to me to see. I actually wrote my dissertation on this subject, on how Christianity relates to Chinese culture in particular.
Mm. And as you've looked around and seen the diversity of belief, particularly obviously your experience in China, where of course Christianity has seen a huge growth in the last 50 years or so, How do you kind of see that when you look at the writings of, you know, skeptics and secularists, particularly in the West? Do you think there's a mismatch that when they're talking often to Western Christianity, that they're not seeing the full picture at some level?
Well, there's a Chinese proverb about a frog that lives in a well, and he looks up through the well and he sees the sky, but he only sees a very small part of the sky. And it's not just John. I credit John for bringing this subject up again. This is a question that has been raised all the way back to the Epicureans in ancient Greece. It's a very important question, how Christianity relates to other religions. It seems to me that almost every, it's like buttered bread. It's the new invention. It's the best thing on the block right now. Almost every skeptic is bringing up this argument in one way or another. And I think John probably deserves a lot of credit for reintroducing it into the discussion.
I mean, as far as you're concerned, in your experience, when it comes to the different objections that are leveled then against Christianity, do you feel like this is one that has a particular potency? That I suppose it's linked to that very common question, you know, how can Christianity of all the religions claim to be true when there are so many making competing truth claims?
Exactly. So this is one of the big questions.
Yeah. And so, I mean, are you finding that asked a lot these days? Do you find that asked in the cultures that you go to and visit, where perhaps another belief system is predominant?
Well, certainly, and this is a question that, all the way back to early Christianity. Christianity was birthed into a plural system where in ancient Greece and Rome, where there were all kinds of different religions, some of which resemble some of the religions of China today. So the question of how Christianity relates to the marketplace of faiths and of beliefs and of ideologies has been with us from day one. It's not a new question. But in our day, when the world is becoming one in many ways, and we're a global village, as they put it, it's become increasingly important for us to consider whether we're in the West or whether we're in Asia. And from an Asian perspective, Christianity came as a colonial master in many eyes. And so people saw it as an invader and as an enemy. And therefore, it's really quite amazing the effect that Christianity has had on Asian cultures.
Well, perhaps we'll get to some of that a little later on. But it's great to have you on the program today, David, to talk about the outsider test for faith and why, as you say in your new book, you claim Christianity passes it. If you want links to both those who are joining me on the program today, John and David, don't forget you can find that at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable with today's show. Let's talk to John Loftus, our other guest on the program today. John, thanks for joining us again on the program. We've heard your story. I won't ask you to repeat it now, of how you lost your faith as a Christian, though it's an interesting one to go into. I'll make sure we link to some episodes in the past where you've talked about that a bit more length. But talk to us about the outsider test for faith, because I think it's really important we establish what that is and why you believe it shows that Christians, if they rightly considered their beliefs, would and should abandon them.
Well, yeah. You know, there's lots of evidence that we believe what we were raised to believe on our mama's knees. I mean, it's we didn't know to do otherwise. And yet, when it comes to religious faith and a lot of other, almost everything, we're taught different things on our mama's knees. And so, my argument is that when we decided to, become adults and to join the adult community, we need to question what mama taught us. And that's really hard to do because we love our mamas. But if we were raised in a snake handler's family, we would think that's normal. Mm. And if we were raised as Scientologists or Mormons, or Catholics or Protestants, Confucianists, we would just think that's normal until we, walk outside, I suppose, or we move to a different country or a different place like Dave Marshall has in China. What we have to do is we have to examine what our mama taught us about our religion, because there are mutually exclusive religions out there. So, I just propose a test that says that we should approach our own religious faith, the one we inherited from our mom, dad, and uncles and brothers, and significant others or teachers. We should approach our own inherited faith from the same standpoint as we approach the religions that we don't believe in, we reject. And I asked myself, how do we do this? And we we assume that those stories are false. I mean, you just talk to a Christian and you ask them what they think about Islam, and they say, well, that's wrong. They don't believe in Jesus, or, you know, I mean, that's a mischaracterization, I grant you. But they'll say things like that. They don't even understand the religion that they reject. And when they do begin to understand some of it, they just simply reject it. Where's the evidence, they might say? Or it just doesn't comport with what I believe, as if that's the standard, of course, for what we have to ask ourselves, whether or not that's a good reason to reject anything if the standard doesn't stand up to the same kinds of evidence that would be required to accept a different religion. So the outsider test of faith is simply a non-double standard for examining religious faith. And it gives the standard, and that is the same things that you would require of another religion, you should require of your own faith. And I grant that there could possibly be a religion that would pass the test. It's not... Anybody who reads my book and comes away thinking otherwise is really misguided.
And is your view, and from what I remember, you know, when we last discussed this, I think it was with Randall Rouser, actually, a couple of years ago now, John. But I think his one of the areas he pressed you on was whether atheism as a belief system, as a worldview, shouldn't equally be, you know, run through the outsider test of faith experiment, and that too has, you know, questionable assumptions and you know, aspects of which can't be proved.
I want to say thanks to David Marshall, actually, because there are a lot of Christian philosophers who have ignorantly, in my opinion, rejected the outsider test for faith. Randall Rouser being one of them, Victor Ruppert being another, Matthew Flanagan wrote the worst possible review you could ever imagine in a Christian journal. I mean, it was just blatantly dishonest, if you ask me. But David Marshall, at least, is smart enough to realize, you know, you can't really kick against the goats. The outsider test of faith is a good standard. It's valid, and I want to thank him for doing that. So I find Randall Rouser is basically debating himself here, because, like you said in that earlier program, he was questioning the value of the outsider test of faith, and he has rejected it, and he maintains that it has no validity. Now he's endorsing David Marshall's book. It's like, my opinion of Randall Rouser is that he'll do and say anything.
Well, that, Randall's not here to defend himself, so I guess we perhaps shouldn't press too far into that, but obviously Randall.
Well, in Randall's defense, it is a good book.
Well, look, we'll. I'm sure it's got many commendations apart from Randall Rouser, but Randall, who I know is a regular listener as well as an occasional contributor to Unbelievable, feel free to send in your responses too, and we'll make sure your voice is heard at some point. But in any case, John,
just ask him why the change of tune. Why is it that on the one hand he rejects it, and the other hand he endorses the book that embraces it?
Well, let's find out just how far David Marshall does embrace it, because I think that's an important question.
Well, it's a complicated question. It's not a black and white sort of thing entirely. Now, I agree with what John just said about not having a double standard. And I think that, first of all, to put the record straight, I think that this idea of the outsider test of faith was invented by the ancient Greeks. It was repeated by G.K. Chesterton in his masterpiece, The Everlasting Man, and I actually brought the same question up myself in a book in the year 2000. And I said, go ahead and look through the whole world. Go wear out your tennis shoes through the libraries of Alexandria and Tibet, and you know, then come and see who Jesus is after you've looked at all the other religions in the world. So yeah, I do think, and I thought before I read John's interesting suggestion, that this is a very valid question to ask, very important question to ask. But I also agree with Randall that, I wouldn't say atheism per se. I would say secular humanism and communism, which are more developed ideologies, well, they have some skin in the game too. Christianity should be judged in a more objective way. We should look at Christianity from the outside, as it were. We should also look at secular humanism and other atheistic ideologies from the outside as well.
So you, in that sense, then say yes. There's a valid question on the table here. I mean, in the way that John has then spelt out the outsider test of faith and the reasons why he believes Christianity fails it, along with every other religion, as far as he's concerned. Any specific areas you wanted to pick up in terms of criticism of the general concept of the outsider test of faith?
Well, besides the fact that we have to look at it, as John said, objectively, and we have to think of our own position as well as other positions, one of the problems is you have to consider the whole difficulty of converting in other religions. Mm. It's very difficult to get outside of your own skin. Mm. And in John's original formatting, his original description of the outsider test for faith, he said, well, why is everybody in Saudi Arabia a Muslim? Why don't they all become Christians? Well, the obvious answer is because if you become a Christian in Saudi Arabia, your life is in danger. I'm paraphrasing. I mean, we can look back at your original post and you know, if you put it more, you know, if you want to get the exact quote in what you say, I don't have the exact quote before me, but Saudi Arabia was the context in which you raised the outsider test for faith originally. And that's particularly interesting because it points to the fact that, this is not it can be very difficult to convert to other religions. So we have to take that into consideration as we consider why people outside of our faith or outside of the Western tradition don't become Christians. And at the same time, we shouldn't be naive about Western civilization either. It's not all, mama taught me this on my mother's knee. You know, mama taught us Christianity on our mother's knee. And then we went to a secular school and we're often told some things that went against Christianity, as I've seen in the public school system myself as a substitute teacher. Even in America, and I'm sure it's the same way in the United Kingdom, what we learn from Monday to Friday, 6 or 7 hours a day, is not necessarily in favor of Christianity.
Indeed. Well, look, obviously, in that sense, it's not that easy to sort of simply be objective, you know, and we would all convert if there was really enough evidence from Christianity and so on, because obviously different places and perspectives will have all kinds of pressures on them. I mean, do you want to come back on any of this, John, before we get some of the... yeah, go on, Ed.
I understand that it can be hard to convert if you live in a Muslim country. I mean, I do understand that. My questions are, why is it that so many people believe what their culture teaches them? I mean, and, you know, I understand that there may be unbelievers in Muslim countries, but why is it so many people believe what their cultures teach them? And you know, in America, you know, if you're raised by a conservative evangelical family, then most likely, not always, but most likely, your uncles and your grandmother and your mom and dad's friends from church, they all believe the same sort of thing. And yes, you do have, you know, the outside influences of culture, secular culture, that might chip away at the certainty of how you were raised. I understand all that. But there's also a lot in the secular culture that is Christianized. You know, words and names and, you know, cities and streets, street names. Corpus Christi, Texas, you know, in God we trust on the dollar, Pledge of Allegiance.
Are you saying God. We somehow imbibe a Christian ethos and worldview through those parts
of
culture?
Well, you know, we do come from a past, you know, where the Puritans came and they wanted to escape some persecution, so the story goes, and I suppose that's true. And we have a lot of Christian symbols in our culture, and, you know, praying before town council meetings and things like that. And you get the idea that, okay, whenever the word God is mentioned and that we believe in God, then the person who was raised by a conservative Christian family will always interpret that word God to mean their God.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, we believe in that kind of God, and there's a lot that reinforces that sort of stuff. And to the degree, I say, that the culture reinforces that which your parents have taught you, then you're going to have that same sort of belief. I mean, it's just, you know, you could just jump it up to 90-95% of the time that's going to happen. And
so your view is essentially that in the vast majority of cases, people who subscribe to a particular religion, it's not been via a process of rationally assessing the evidence for it and coming to a considered decision. It's something that sort of, yeah, from the mother's knee, as you say, and is cultural and everything else. I mean, at some level, David, I'm assuming you're not going to disagree that, of course, a lot of, you know, cultural stuff comes into the decision a person makes about what religion they subscribe to.
Well, culture pulls in all different kinds of ways, all different directions. And sometimes I find that Chinese can be a little more objective about it because they weren't raised in an objective and a fair-minded way and say, yeah, so why do you believe in God? And when they ask the question, why do you believe in God, they actually want to hear the answer. And a lot of times in the West, people have been programmed against Christianity. Many people have been programmed against Christianity. And there are some also who are programmed for Christianity. So in a sense, I do agree with John that it's good to take an look at things from the outside. We can check our homework. With the other kids can help us check our homework. And I think that's a good thing.
Okay. I do want us to kind of get into the meat of your book, though, particularly, David, and your reasons why Christianity, if we kind of, you know, take in general terms, at least, this outsider test of faith as a good way of trying to decide on what we should believe, why Christianity, as far as you're concerned, does pass it with flying colours. And we're going to come to that in just a moment's time. Just a quick reminder, if you're listening and you'd like to get involved on this discussion, be interested in hearing your responses to today's show. You can email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also get in touch via the Facebook and Twitter accounts at UnbelievableJB to follow me on Twitter. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB is the Facebook page. And of course, all of those links and more and opportunity to comment on today's show from the Unbelievable website. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So, David, just develop a little bit, at least. We're not going to be able to do justice to these huge topics, but essentially a main claim in your new book is that, in fact, Christianity, by sheer force of the way it has succeeded historically and globally in capturing hearts and minds, at some level does pass the outsider test for faith. And you link that as well to the promises of Scripture in the Old Testament, Abraham and so on. Just give us a flavour then of where this response to the outsider test is coming from.
Yes, well, John speaks of thousands or tens of thousands of competing religions, and we have to be objective, and therefore there's a huge odds against our particular religion being true. But I think we can narrow that down a little bit by looking at the religions that actually have passed the test, not just, you know, in the subjective consciousness of an atheist from Indiana, but where the rubber meets the road in the real world, as belief systems spread around the world and people evaluate them given their own presuppositions. I think there are five faith systems that have succeeded. First of all, in the first sense, the first way that Christianity has passed the outsider test is simply by raw success in winning minds and hearts around the world. And there are basically five belief systems that can be said to have passed that test to some extent, mm-hmm. which would be, first, the first one was Buddhism. The second one is Christianity. The third would be Islam, which basically spread by violence, primarily. The fourth one is Marxism, which spread the same way. And that fifth one could be said to be secular humanism. And of those five belief systems, I think that Christianity has succeeded the best and has won different cultures.
Why don't you include, just quickly, the Hinduism, for instance? Is it because it hasn't been a spreading religion? It's more been contained within its where it began.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Although arguably Hinduism, because a lot of its ideas have spread pretty widely, you could possibly include Hinduism as well.
Okay, so you've said all five of these that you lay out have had some success in you know being adopted, you know around the world. So, is there any reason why Christianity stands in any way head and shoulders above those others, or is it just a competing marketplace?
Well. It's spread further, and it's been adopted by more people. So if we're going to, and also because Islam and communism spread mostly through violence. Now, I think there's a core truth to both Islam and communism that people recognized, and therefore that helped it to spread further because Islam, a lot of people around the world recognized that there was one creator, God, and that was
helpful for the spread of Islam. And a lot of people recognize the need for justice, and they recognize the injustice of the Industrial Revolution in certain periods and colonialism, and that aided in the spread of communism. So there's truth at the core of both of those religions, but force and violence were their main weapons. They spread by the sword. Buddhism spread peacefully, but it utterly transformed when it came to East Asia. So what actually spread was not necessarily the original teachings of Buddha. Secular humanism has maybe not quite as had a great as much success. Mostly secular humanism has also spread peacefully, but it hasn't quite gone as far as Christianity. So this is kind of a rough way of comparing belief systems, and I'm not saying that it's a real strong.
And just before we come back to John for his response, why then does the success of Christianity at some level mean it passes the outsider test for faith? I think that's the dot we need to join here. Why does that mean that it is objectively, as it were, makes more sense, if you like, you're objectively allowed, if you like, justified, let's say, believing in Christianity because of this fact of its success?
Because each time Christianity passed a new cultural barrier from Israel to Greece, from Greece to the different parts of Europe, from Europe to India and different parts of the world, each tribe in Africa, they had to evaluate from their point of view and say, is this something that fits with what we believe? Is this something we can believe given our presuppositions, given our understanding about life? And the fact that rational human beings decided that, yes, Christianity did work for them, that it seemed reasonable for them to accept, it should give us pause. I'm not saying it's proof of anything, but I think it should give people pause.
Well, that's a great place to start. And with those thoughts in mind, we're going to take a quick break and come straight back to John Loftus, who is the originator of this so-called outsider test for faith that David Marshall, our Christian guest, is responding to. So come back with us in just a few minutes' time as we go to the second part of today's Unbelievable, asking why Christianity, among all the world religions, deserves to be believed, and can it, as it were, hold its own against all the other belief systems that are out there. John Loftus says no, it can't, and for that reason we should reject them all. They don't pass the so-called outsider test for faith, and we'll be back discussing this again in a moment's time here on the show that aims to get you thinking Unbelievable.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
With the film version of best-selling erotic novel 50 Shades of Grey set to hit UK cinemas, in the latest magazine we examine the new permissiveness in pornography. Labour leader Ed Miliband sits down to talk to us about church, and we find out why an evangelical church in Cairo has had a miraculous role in healing Egypt's recent political turmoil. All that, plus interviews, news, reviews, and your favourite column.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme, Unbelievable, with me, Justin Brierley. Don't forget, this show brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine, where I'm the senior editor, all part of Faith Explored on Saturday afternoons here on Premier Christian Radio. And if you want to find out more about my guests, past shows, features, resources and much, much more, do visit the website of the show. That's premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. Today on the programme, we're asking, does Christianity pass the outsider test for faith? What is that? Well, it's the terminology has been developed by John Loftus. He's well known as an ex-Christian, now an atheist online, and for his books, which he claims debunk the Christian faith. He formulated this outsider test for faith, believing that Christians, if they examined their beliefs as sceptically as they do other belief systems, would and should abandon their faith. Well, that's not the way David Marshall sees it. He's my Christian guest on today's programme. Based out in China, he's been a student of world religions in many ways, and his latest book, How Christianity Passes the Outsider Test, is a response to John Loftus, and he believes that in multiple ways Christianity is unique among world religions and should be taken seriously for that reason. So we were hearing just in that last section, John, one of the prime reasons that David believes that we should take Christianity seriously is because of its raw success. It has, if you like, passed the test by going into multiple different cultures, being accepted, adopted and so on. Should that give us pause for thought and make us consider whether Christianity perhaps does have a uniqueness, a power that makes it pass the test?
Yeah, there's a lot I could say in response. First of all, I mean, if you'd give me a moment or two, equal time, if you will.
Sure, yeah.
First of all, which Christianity? Each of these different cultures are embracing some of Christianity and some of their own traditions and beliefs. And what happens is that when Christianity goes into different cultures, there's a syncretization process that takes place so that some people and some tribes can embrace things that other people in other cultures wouldn't embrace at all and condemn as heresy, even though they're both Christians. Okay, so which Christianity is actually being embraced? It's the one closest, the one most appealing to the religion that already exists there.
Okay.
And what if you give me equal time? Another thing is, Christianity really offers the most wonderful story out there. Really, God would come down and die for our sins. We all feel guilty about something, and so if someone says, well, you know what, you can be forgiven for all you did wrong, here's how it had to take place. Jesus had to die for your sins, and he was the Son of God, and wow, isn't that wonderful? I mean, in a superstitious world where you couldn't, verify the evidence for yourself, you couldn't go see the empty tomb, for instance, there's a lot of hearsay going on, edited stories that wound up in the New Testament. I mean, it's just a wonderful story. I mean, who wouldn't want to embrace it? That's one of the things I face all the time when I'm trying to convince others that the story itself is not the evidence. So, and there's evidence that the story isn't true because the very people who should have known better would be the Jews of the first century. And we know there are about 8 million of them in the known world. And David Sims, a scholar I linked to in my book, he calculates that by the end of the first century, only 1,000 Jews were Christians. I mean, they knew their prophecies in the Old Testament. They believed in the same God. They believed in the hope of the Messiah. And they believed in miracles that Yahweh did miracles. I mean, they had all the right things that would be there to accept Christianity. And they were there, and they saw, and they rejected. So I asked, why should I have to embrace something that they, who know better, didn't?
Mm.
And two more things, if you would.
Yeah, please. I mean, let's rattle them out, and we can then sort of try and just discuss them one at a time, and I'll try and yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's simply not true. I think David hinted at that earlier in his book. He admits that Christianity was spread by the sword. I have a new book out called Christianity is Not Great. You can find it online. David Eller has a wonderful chapter in there about the spread of Christianity, colonialism, and what it did to other cultures. It destroyed some indigenous peoples and it destroyed their cultures. It did indeed spread by the sword. And the last thing I want to say is this. The idea that Christianity succeeded, and I understand David's point because he reiterated earlier about it crossing cultures. The fact that Christianity succeeded in places is not part of the outsider test for faith. Otherwise, like you said, Buddhism would pass it, and I guess he just admitted Hinduism would, and by all accounts, Mormonism is passing it, and so is Scientology today. Success is not an indicator of a religion that's true. And probably not at all. It depends on the culture. For instance, I would be impressed if evangelical Christianity succeeded in America today or in Europe. I would be more impressed because we're more scientifically enlightened.
Mm.
If you talk about the first century, second century, down through the first millennium, the rise of science had not occurred yet. And so you're talking at where if Christianity was successful in Africa and Asia like it is right now, you're talking about a superstitious people.
Okay, so it's more likely to be accepted in pre-scientific cultures than someone that... Right. Well, there's lots to tackle there, and I do want to give you a chance to sort of dialogue in this way rather than us just to try and do long checklists of objections and responses. So what I'm going to say is that I think particularly the question of whether Christianity was spread by the sword is in itself a really big topic, and perhaps we'll hive that off for another show. Hopefully maybe next week we can pick that up. But David,
I'm an historian of religions, and the answer is no.
Well, okay. Well, let's put that one to one side and say we'll maybe tackle that next week, because I think that's a huge area.
In 10 out of 12 periods.
Well, let's
two periods possible.
Let's get some of the other objections then, and I'll bring John back in to kind of have a discussion on this. Which Christianity was the first one? You know, it's come up in all kinds of ways and tends to get syncretized, says John, depending on the culture it comes into. So what's your comeback on this? And we'll let John also dialogue on this, David.
Well, all belief systems tend to mix, and that's true of atheistic ideologies as well. Right now, I'm seeing before my very eyes here in China that communism is starting to mix with Confucianism and with some even Christian values. They have a campaign right now where they put core socialist values all over the place here on the street corners, and those core socialist values are actually more Confucian values with a little bit of Christianity mixed in, and quotes from Confucius and translated by a missionary by the name of James Lake. So that's true of all belief systems, but Christianity tends to syncretize less than Buddhism or communism, I think. And the reason for that is we have a core basis of belief, which is the Bible. And a lot of times East Asian Christians are very firm in what they believe. And it's, you know, I remember reading Augustine when I was a young man and saying, hey, this guy from the 4th century, North Africa, he's my brother. He's my brother. So many cultural divides between us, and yet I recognized his faith and what he was saying. Maybe we didn't agree on everything, but I recognized him as having something core in common with him, with me.
So you don't see it as bad as John paints out in terms of the.
I don't think it's as bad as John says. I mean, there is syncretism. There are cults. But Christianity itself,
I think one of the things some people are worried about is the rise of a sort of very, I don't know, prosperity-driven type of Christian focus in some parts of Africa and so on, that maybe is buying into a certain type of Christianity from the West.
Well, around the fringes of when every religion spreads, around the fringes, there's always things like that. So I admit that.
Well, let's hear from John. Go on, John.
Thank you. It happened in the first century. Bart Ehrman's research into first century Christian beliefs, he says they were more diverse than they are today. In a book called Lost Christianities, and you know, it's quite fascinating to read. There was a real war of ideas which Christianity would be predominant. So it's been there from the first.
Okay. Any response?
Well, Ehrman tends to think that the Gnostics were Christians too, which I wrote a book specifically refuting that. So I would definitely just disagree with Ehrman on that subject.
I mean, what about this fact that, you know, and it's interesting to hear you say this, John, and I remember when I first interviewed you, you said the same thing, but Christianity is a wonderful story. Who wouldn't want to believe that God came and died for our sins and so on? So it's kind of inevitable that people will want to believe such a lovely story. Any response on that, David, and then I'll bring John in again?
People have mixed motives. And a lot of times the people who end up becoming Christians didn't want to originally. It's very interesting to read the stories of people who convert to Christianity. A lot of times their stories, they're very diverse, and the reasons they come to faith in Christ are very diverse. And their motives are almost always mixed. So it's not an either-or sort of thing, I don't think. But for Christianity to spread into other cultures is incredibly difficult for a new faith, people with long noses and white skin and speaking the language poorly, to bring their faith into your marketplace and say, hey, this is the truth, and it connects with your beliefs somehow. That is an incredibly difficult mission to accomplish.
Okay, John.
It's not easy.
No, really, I mean, David is in denial. Just read David Eller's chapter on how Christianity actually spread. So Constantine, for instance, he saw a cross in the sky, so to speak, and he said, "Okay, now all you Christians, you come together, and I want to have one, government or one religion. And you guys fight it out," and they did. In the 4th through 8th centuries, I mean, there were wars that obliterated other peoples. And the winners of those wars were settled by 4 patriarchs and 3 queens and a host of forces. So the doctrines that David now embraces and a lot of other Christians were the result of these wars, a lot of bloodshed. And that's just the start. You know, that's just the start of Christianity. So, no, he's just in denial. That's all I got to say about that. I mean, just read the chapter, read up on the literature.
Okay, David, a response on that one?
I think there's a pretty objective and very very scholarly book, Fletcher, I can't think of the first name at the moment, called The Pagan Conversion or something along those lines. It's very interesting. It tells the whole story of how Europe converted. There, as I said, there are 12 periods in which Christianity has really run wild. And of those 12 periods, two of them you might possibly say that force was a factor at certain times. The conversion of Northern Europe might be one of those. But the original rise of Christianity was not. Most of the time, no. Christianity has spread because people wanted to believe. And actually, when people used force to force people to believe in Christianity, often it created a Christo-paganism sort of thing in which people were really not that pious, as Rodney Stark shows in his article, Secularism, Rest in Peace, R.I.P. He shows that in the Middle Ages, when people were forced in some cases to believe, they really didn't believe very much because there was a monopoly of belief top down, and that really doesn't produce much faith.
It doesn't.
You know, there's an author that Christians love to quote. His name is Philip Jenkins. He's written several different books. And they'll quote him on this topic and on that topic. But he wrote a book called The Jesus Wars. Here's a subtitle: How Four Patriarchs, Three Queens, and Two Emperors Decided What Christians Would Believe for the Next 1,500 Years. I submit that book as a rebuttal. That's just the first.
Philip Jenkins recommended two of my books, by the way.
well, look, David, the political aspect of Christianity and how, you know, yes, kings and queens and so on, emperors have shaped to some extent the history of Christianity. I mean, is this a kind of an objection per se to Christian faith and how it therefore fails the outsider test for faith?
I don't know.
You don't.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess we've kind of gone off the tracks a little bit here.
We have a bit, but what's, I don't know, what's your response to that? Is it a problem that Christianity has a political history as well as obviously the faith?
Obviously, for the first 300 years, Christianity was a persecuted religion, and that's when the Christian scriptures took form, and that is, I mean, Christianity wasn't persecuted for the first 300 years?
Candida Mass's book,
says,
argues very cogently that those stories were concocted. That is, they were made up by Christians. The martyrdom of Christians and the white sail persecution of Christians was just a made-up tale.
Well, Christians were not persecuted for the first 300 years. Is that what you're claiming, John? Are you on the record here?
There's always some persecution. In fact, the very fact that there were wars over what Christians would believe would be indicative of the fact that those who claimed to be Christians were persecuted and killed. But the winners of those wars decided a church orthodoxy for the next 1,500 years. So, yeah, there was some persecution of...
There was a great deal of persecution over the first 300 years, but the main point here is that Christianity did not spread by violence in the first 300 years. It took form, took shape, and the canon was developed during a period in which Christianity was a persecuted minority religion. And that's, for me, Jesus Christ is the norm.
I mean, I feel like we can come back to the issues around how Christianity spread and whether it was by the sword and so on. Maybe pick those up, as I say, next week again. But a significant one again, and sorry to move on at a fair pace, but was this other objection John has, that as far as he's concerned, there was hardly any take up by first century Jews of this new religion, the fulfillment of Judaism as it was claimed. So is this not itself obvious evidence that it doesn't fulfill the outsider test of faith if the people it most directly applied to didn't believe it at the time?
Well, I think Rodney Stark is a wonderful source on this too, the rise of Christianity. He shows, well, first of all, every new belief system begins with a small group. That's one of his principles as a sociologist of religion, is every new belief system begins with a small group. But he shows that Christianity actually did do quite well among Jews for the first few hundred years. And that's why that huge number of Jews decreased over those years, because many of them had converted. It's true that originally Christianity arose among a fairly small group of people. There were, I think, 1,000 it's not really that small, even though Stark uses that figure himself. That's how every new belief system starts. That's how communism started. That's how a lot of secular humanist ideas started, too. I don't really think that's I think that's how John Loftus's ideas started, too. They started with one person. Does that mean they're wrong? I don't think so.
John?
Well, the point is missed by David. And the idea that the Jews who were theists, I mean, they were theists in every sense of the term, as Christians were later. That is, they believed in God and miracles and prophecy, and they had, I mean, they were the owners of the texts themselves. They lived in the same era, they lived in the same time period, and they overwhelmingly rejected it. David Sims, SIM, article in page 248 of my book, I footnote it. He talks about how many Jews there were at the end of the first century, concludes there are 1,000. Now, that just doesn't seem to be a very good conversion ratio when there's 8 million Jews in the known world at the time. They overwhelmingly rejected the Christian faith. And I think that's significant. I don't see why I should believe if they didn't. They were there. Why didn't they believe? And when you consider the kinds of things that you're told to believe in the Christian scriptures, you know, I can see why they would reject the Christian message. First off, there is no prophecy in the Old Testament that is considered a prophecy that points to Jesus as the Messiah. There's no prophecy that talks about him being raised from the dead. There's no prophecy that talks about him dying on the cross. There's no idea in the Old Testament of a dying Savior. No, it's just not there.
Let's again allow David to pick up on some of these points. I mean, obviously, we're familiar as Christians to read the accounts of Paul evangelizing both Jews and Gentiles in the New Testament, David. But you know, if we accept that maybe, you know, by the end of the first century, there was a relatively limited number compared to the overall population of Jews in the world that had actually converted. Is it because they simply weren't convinced by the claims of Christianity, by the claims of Paul? What's your take on this?
Well, probably first of all, the overwhelming number of them had probably never really
had the
heard
opportunity
the gospel.
To hear that, for sure.
Right. Mm-hmm. And secondly, of course, there was social pressure. Social pressure is incredibly important when it comes to conversion, and it usually keeps conversion down. I know a lot about this because here in Asia, in many countries, less than 1% of the people are Christians, and that's primarily because Christianity came associated with imperialistic powers, and therefore
and
it was associated
with
imperialism.
And the social pressure being essentially
forms
of persecution.
In the Jewish case, the leaders of the Jewish people, the Pharisees, as the Gospels very clearly explain, opposed Jesus, and at a time, this is a time when the Roman Empire was crushing the Jewish people, and in 70 AD, they really did nuke Jerusalem, basically, and destroy the Jewish nation. There would have been incredible pressure to conform to what the Jewish people, what the Jewish high priests and leaders told them was normative Judaism. However, I think there were more than 1,000 Christians by 100 AD, and Christianity did spread rather rapidly among Jews as well as among Gentiles, although there was more resistance because there was more social pressure.
Before we go back to John as well, his other claim is simply that from his point of view, it's actually because Christianity didn't fulfill what the Jews were expecting from the Messiah. What's your take on that? Do you think that was a factor in why they...
I think John is mistaken right down the line on that. I mean, looking at Isaiah 53 and Isaiah 52 and 53 at Psalm 22, I think that there is a clear concept that there's going to be a suffering Messiah who is going to die, and there is even the idea that he's going to come back from the dead in Isaiah 52 and 53.
Okay, John.
Any scholarly exegesis of the suffering servant passages leads to the idea that the suffering servant is Israel itself.
No, absolutely not.
Look at Isaiah 49, verse 3.
I'll let you come back on this, David, so let's just let John have his say at this point.
Sure.
And there's no passage in any psalm, whether it's 22 or 69 or any of the others, 40, is a prophecy. These are prayers of agony, and anything that might look forward to the hopes of a future messianic age is not a prophecy in the sense of here are the specifics, because every oppressed people are looking for a Messiah, of some kind, a savior, a king, a rabbi, whatever. So that's not a prophecy that this is going to happen. It's just a hope for such a thing. No prophecy in any psalm. Isaiah is not about Jesus. And there's a lot of other kinds of prophecies, so-called prophecies, that are not prophecies at all.
Okay. David, response before we start to wrap up this section?
Well, I didn't expect to talk about Isaiah tonight, I think that it's very, very clear throughout the Old Testament that the description of the suffering servant in Isaiah 52 and 53 is just not the way the Old Testament describes the children of Israel. I mean, the children of Israel are not sinless. They're not, and it even says that the suffering servant is going to redeem his people, Israel, or something like that. I don't have the exact print in front of me right now, but the implication is that the suffering servant is going to act on behalf of the children of Israel. And I don't know how Israel is going to act on its own behalf to save itself somehow. It's clearly referring, there's several things you can go through in that passage, and you can find that it's really talking about a person. Now, there are a few passages in Isaiah where it does seem to refer to Israel in some such way, but overall, I think it's pretty clearly talking about a human being.
Okay, well, we're going to leave that there, I think, just because we don't have time to get... Okay, one response, John. Okay, quick question, John. Okay.
David, after all the interactions that we've had online and what have you, I'm just curious if you've ever read Why I Became an Atheist, my book, my magnum opus.
Not yet. I've read most of your books. I think you've read one of my books, right?
Yes. That's my magnum opus. And in that book, I have a chapter on prophecy. It's a long chapter. I suggest you read it. I quote from Christian scholars on these topics, the topics of prophecy. And it is as I say.
Well, I've written on that chapter myself, but that sounds interesting. Maybe I'll do that sometime.
Well, look, we don't have time to go into a whole show on whether Jesus fulfilled messianic prophecies or not. But in any case, let's try and just I tell you what, let's go to a break, and then we'll come back and give ourselves a little more time to maybe pick up on another area that John wanted to talk about as well. We're talking today about whether Christianity passes the outsider test for faith. If you put Christianity alongside all the other world religions, and if you like asked an outsider to choose one, would Christianity come out top, or would actually that outsider reject them all, believing that they're all contradict each other and none of them can be objectively believed? Well, that's the view of John Loftus, our atheist on the program today. He's well known for this so-called outsider test for faith. If you want to find out more about him, links to his work from today's program at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. But in response, David Marshall today, our Christian thinker on the program, based out in China and a student of world religions, says actually Christianity does pass the outsider test. In fact, that's what he called his new book. Again, if you want more info on him and the book, links from today's program online. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Unbelievable. We'll be coming back as we continue this discussion here on Unbelievable, the program that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. Welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, part of Faith Explored on Premier Christian Radio. Faith Explored is our programming between about 1 in the afternoon and 5 in the afternoon that helps you to think through your faith. Lots of it is available online. Things like The Profile, if you go to premierchristianradio.com/theprofile, you should be able to listen to the most recent editions of that. And coming up between 4 and 5, today's profile guest with Maria Rodriguez, our Vineyard church leader Christy Wimber and Ugandan missionary Marilyn Skinner. Both have extraordinary stories to tell. You'll be interested to listen to them. And of course, Unbelievable is available to listen back to online. Many people do that week to week. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there to further resources, past shows, and indeed ways to comment on the programme too. Lots of people have been leaving comments under last week's week's programme on Christian humanism. I shall read some of those. Also by email they've come in, and I'm going to read later on Arnold's one, who says, "You got me again, fuming to respond. Good work." So we'll hear what he has to say, among others, as well as hearing more response to the episode on hell and mathematics. We cover a fair range of topics on Unbelievable, don't we? That's all to come. Don't forget that if you're in next week for the programme, you can hear part two of today's show. Essentially, we're continuing the conversation next week between my guests on the programme today as we continue to look at the outsider test for faith.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, we're into the final part of today's programme and our discussion on the so-called outsider test for faith. My two guests joining me today on the programme have been David Marshall, who's a Christian author and thinker, and atheist John Loftus, a former Christian. And as I mentioned earlier on in the programme, if you want to hear more shows in which John has contributed and indeed spelled out some of his story, then I'll make sure there are links to some of those with today's programme. In the meantime, we've been going around lots of different objections, counters to and fro on this question of whether Christianity, you know, is rationally adoptable, you know, in different cultures and situations, and whether it's spread by force or whether it was adopted, you know, because it fulfilled people's need for God and because the story is eminently believable. And we got to a point, I think, David, where we'd covered off a number of issues that John brought back to you when it comes to why you do believe Christianity passes this so-called outsider test for faith. But in the end, he said that the fact that Christianity succeeded, which is a fundamental part of what you've said today, is not part of the outsider test of faith. That doesn't tell us actually anything about its truth and whether it actually is objectively believable.
Well, Aristotle said that aside from checking things directly, scientifically, he said that we can also ask the old, the wise, and the skillful about truth, and we can find truth indirectly that way. And I think that if we are the frog in the well and we're looking at the world through our little hole and looking at the sky from our own individual subjective perspective, we're likely to miss something. So I think we should hear what humanity has to say. The old outsider test should be more than just a rhetorical exercise to win points in an argument. It should be about the total human experience and the search for ultimate truth. And therefore, we allow other cultures to help us sift truth, because people at different periods and different times, whether they're Gnostics or Hindus or Buddhists or secular humanists or people of different cultures and different belief systems, they're going to have some insight. They're going to have some way of looking at the truth and giving it a few hard knocks and you know, kicking the tires a little bit and saying, you know, what is there to this? Is there something to it? Is there something true about this? So we should listen to humanity. We should hear what the rest of the humanity has to say. And when we do that, we find that Christianity comes out pretty well.
What, I mean, before we come back to John, I'm interested in your personal experience. You live and work in China a lot of the time. And as I've mentioned, we have seen this explosion, really, of the Christian church in China, even within, you know, it being this very sort of nailed down Marxist regime. And what's going on there then? Why are people adopting, as far as you can see from their history, why is it so fertile to the Christian faith? It must be more than just, oh, that looks like a rationally justifiable set of beliefs. It must be answering more than that when it comes to why people adopt Christianity in China.
Well, I was talking to my business partner yesterday, and she's sort of Buddhist, but she's had some dreams about Christianity, and she's kind of thinking about it a little bit. And she said, you know, I believe in God. I'm a theist. Now, if we say I believe in God, John used the word Shangdi, which is the Chinese word for God, as one of his alternative gods to look at. Well, Shangdi is not a Western god. Shangdi is not a god in the Anglo-Saxon sense, but he is God. He's the supreme God who's the father of all, and he's good and benevolent and above everything else, far above any spirits. And belief in Shangdi goes back to the five classics of ancient China, the book of poetry and the book of history, especially, which are the earliest of the classics. And if you look at those books, the greatest Western scholar of those books, a guy named James Legg, when he sifted those books over 30 years, he came to the conclusion Shangdi is to the Chinese just what God is to our fathers and our forefathers. So here I come to this place that's so far removed from Western civilization, and I find that, first of all, there's an understanding, a recognition of the Supreme God who shares many of the same characteristics in cultures very diverse and very far apart from my own culture. Now I forgot your question.
Well, it was why is, if you like, China so fertile, apparently, given its Marxist history to Christianity? And so you say, yes, there is already this concept of God which seems to you know, that Christianity can speak into.
There's all kinds of things that point to Jesus in the Chinese culture and in other cultures.
Yeah, and so when you find people adopting the Christian faith, is it because when they hear the story, or they it somehow fits in with everything they've been looking for? Is it also, you know, you talked about dreams and so on. Are there supernatural things happening which seem to be drawing people to faith, particularly in Christianity?
Yes, and as I said before, converting outside of your own belief system to another culture, it's another belief system from outside. It's very difficult. So there's all kinds of things that prod or push from the inside, push people to Christ. And miracles are among those reasons. I've met lots of people here who have had those sorts of experiences. Recognition that the gospel fulfills very important truth, things that are very important to them, is also another very important element.
And so then coming back to this question that we began with, why you do believe then Christianity succeeded is a relevant factor in the outside Sourdough test of faith, it's because it's a multiplicity of factors that we're looking at, as far as you're concerned, with why a belief system is adopted and makes sense within different cultures.
Yeah, people are both rational and irrational. You know, people have, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. You know, so there's the moral, there's the existential, and there's the rational. People are a mix of those things. And we find truth, we seek truth, we also run from truth. And we have mixed motives, but there are things within us. I think all those three of those things, there's truth to those things. There's truth to morality. There's truth to beauty. There's truth to the search for life, greater life. And we also have a driving need to know what's true about the world.
Well, John, has this at any level answered your objection that as far as you're concerned, Christianity succeeded isn't a valid, part of the outsider test for faith?
No, it's not. It's just, I laid out the criteria, and I don't think anything he said has disputed it. And if you want to know whether a faith is true or not, if you want to examine the faith you inherited, you have to be brutally honest, and it's really hard to do that if you were raised in that particular small culture inside a family in a small church somewhere, or maybe even homeschooled, or at a private school. I mean, that's you have to actually be brutally honest, and merely saying, "Well, you know, our faith has survived." I mean, when other faiths have survived by David Marshall's own telling of the story, that cannot be a rational way to evaluate faith. On page 21 of my Outsider Test for Faith book, I laid out the criteria, and that is you have to assume that your faith has the burden of proof. You have to adopt the methodological naturalist viewpoint by which one assumes there is a natural explanation for the origins of a given religion. I mean, that's what we do with Mormonism, for instance, and Scientology. And three, you have to demand sufficient evidence before concluding a religion is true. I mean, just because a religion grew doesn't mean that the people who first adopted it did so based on sufficient evidence. We know that's not the case.
I guess what David's saying, though, is, and he might want to answer those points, but is that it's not just about, if you like, the textual and historical evidence. It's about whether this worldview answers the moral and social and all kinds of other questions that people might be bringing in when they decide whether they're going to become a Christian at the end of the day.
Well, somebody once recently said to me, "Hey, you can't really accept evolution, because if you did, then all morality is thrown out the window. That's what the comment was. And I said, what's that got to do with the evidence for evolution?
Sure,
see,
yeah.
That actually has nothing to do. I mean, either evolution is the case or it isn't. Consequences come what they may. Now, I don't think morality is thrown out the window.
Yeah, obviously. I think again, though, a Christian could easily come back and say, well, you know, who's a theistic evolutionist, that they don't believe morality goes out the window because they also believe God can be, you know, in part of that system. But David, any responses to this before we have to start to draw things to a close?
Yeah, on what John said on that page was that at best there can be only one religious faith that's true, and Christianity doesn't necessarily agree with that because we think Judaism is also true. But he says that the outsider test adopts the methodological naturalism point of view, which seems to prejudice things a little bit, in which we assume there is a natural explanation for the origins of one's religion, as he just said. That seems to prejudice things in the direction of secular humanism. I think we need to be a little bit more objective, a little more fair in how we formulate the outsider test.
Because that would automatically discount the resurrection of Jesus Christ as being a valid...
At least it would put it... it would put it, be much more skeptical towards non-naturalistic, non-atheistic perspectives than it is towards its own...
What do you say to that, John?
Well, you can adopt methodological naturalism and test for the efficacy of prayer. And that adoption doesn't change the results. Prayer either works or it doesn't. You can adopt methodological naturalism and come up with an astounding amount of evidence for, say, the Exodus and the wilderness wanderings and the conquest of Canaan. And that evidence will then convince people. You can find the pillar of salt that Lot's wife was supposedly changed into with traces of human female DNA in it. That the methodological naturalism has nothing to say about the evidence if the evidence is there.
Okay. Any response before we have to start to wind things up, David?
Well, that's not exactly the way he puts it, but we'll skip that one for now.
Okay. Well, look, it's been really interesting, but we've got another crack of the whip, another bite of the cherry next week, because I'm going to get you guys both back in for next week's program as we continue this. So much area that we haven't covered, and it is a huge one. So appreciate you both being able to join me today from different time zones. We're very much a multinational, intercontinental show today, as David Marshall in China, John Loftus in America, and me, Justin Brierley, here in a studio in London, talk about the outsider test for faith. It's been really interesting getting your perspectives today, gentlemen, and we'll continue this conversation same time next week when we open up areas around, whether your contention, David, that Christianity fulfills the expectations and longings of many world religions is again evidence of it passing the outsider test for faith. But in the meantime, we'll say goodbye. And if you want to get any more information on John and David, as I say, to the Debunking Christianity website that John Loftus runs or David Marshall's writings, just click onto today's show online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. In the meantime, thanks both gentlemen, and I look forward to chatting with you again at the same time next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, time to get to some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme. And we're going to be hearing about the show that started off the new year on hell. And we had a debate on annihilationism, the view that, if you like, the unsaved simply cease to exist. And eternal conscious torment, the traditional view that there is a never-ending state of torment for the unsaved. A theological show, not an easy subject, but one that there was a very robust discussion on. And, of course, last week's was very interesting. Christian humanism was under debate, and whether humanists, i.e. atheist humanists, need God to support their particular view of the dignity of humans and so on. That was Angus Ritchie and Stephen Law on last week's programme. Just as well, wanted to say a hello to anyone who is perhaps listening via podcast because they've been attending the Reasons for God event that took place at St Mary's Church, Bryanston Square in London. I was not able to be there myself, unfortunately, but it's great to know that I think a packed house for that apologetics conference that took place over the weekend. So to our friends at RZIM putting that on, well done. More of the same, please, and we're looking forward to being joined on this programme in the not-too-distant future by Vince Vitale for a great discussion with Julian Bagini on the problem of suffering. Anyway, let's go to some of your emails. Here's Nate, who emails in on that Al Mohler, Chris Date debate on hell. Chris Date taking the annihilationist position, Al Mohler, well known as the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, taking the traditional view. So Nate was not too impressed with Al Mohler. He says, full disclosure, I am basically a traditionalist, but I've been impressed with the conditionalists I've heard and the vigour with which they present their biblical argument. I can certainly see the draw to the view, and Chris did a wonderful job of exegeting scripture in support of it. Mohler, on the other hand, brought virtually no exegesis to the table. The vast majority of what he said filtered down to the church has always said this, or the Bible clearly teaches this. You'd think the president of a theological seminary would be able to bring more exegesis to the table, but all he seemed to do was repeat his own view with the assumption that no one in their right mind would disagree. This is disturbing for a couple of reasons. First, because many people assert him as one of the heavy-hitting intellectual elites of modern evangelicalism, yet he couldn't present really a single exegetical argument after Matthew 25 for his case. Now, I'm going to have to skip out some parts of your email here, Nate, but you say, second, the two prongs of Mohler's argument, church history and the clear teaching of Scripture, are both tools which can easily be used to deconstruct any array of beliefs that Baptists and Calvinists hold for theological persuasions to which Mohler belongs. For instance, infant baptism, church history is in favour. The objective saving nature of baptism. The Bible clearly teaches this in 1 Peter 3:21, the real presence of Christ in the sacraments. Take, eat and eat, this is my body. Justification by faith alone, and so on. So you finish up by saying here, Nate, I'll be the first to cite church history in defence of a doctrine, but let's not use it only when it's convenient and cavalierly dismiss the serious inquiry of someone who has a plain reading of the Bible that differs from ours because the status quo seems to be on our side. Chris Date spoke like a true scholar and an intellectual worth paying serious attention to. If I become a conditionalist, he will be a major reason why. Ray Chung wanted to take issue with the conditionalist view, the annihilationist view, and is referring to an aspect of scripture that we didn't really cover in that program, Daniel 12:2. I wanted to bring that up, and in Daniel 12:2 it says this: multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. And you say that where this has been addressed by conditionalists like Chris Date and Glenn Peoples, they've interpreted this to mean that the saved will be remembering the unsaved with shame and contempt. Chris Date puts it this way: shame and contempt refer not to what somebody feels, but rather to how they're concerned about how they will be remembered. Well, you don't agree with that. You think that's a bit of a spurious interpretation of Daniel 12, verse 2. You say, I think it's possible to offer a far better explanation, one that even meets the criteria of proportionality of punishment. But before putting this forward, let's never forget what God has offered to us through Jesus with wide open arms, if only we'd ask. Here's my take on Dan 12:2. Many of us know what it's like to wake up with that awful thought, oh my God, did I really say or do that? How could I have been so horrible? How could I have been so stupid as to miss my son's play for the sake of a few more minutes at work, etc., etc.? I think this is what Daniel 12:2 is all about. In hell, the unsaved will know perfectly God's righteous demands. They will spend eternity fully cognizant of their own failing, fully ashamed of the things they've done, and fully self-condemning. In hell, there won't be any drinking buddies there, as Dawkins puts it. Hitler and his SS henchmen won't be slapping each other's backs, plotting further atrocities with glee. Instead, they'll be all alone, for community is a gift of God, and that's gone. They'll be in darkness, for only their own gnawing thoughts to dwell on. For eternity, they will not be able to remember the good moments, for goodness belongs to God, and since they've rejected God, all good memories are gone forever. The unsaved will experience the pain they've caused as if they were seeing and feeling it through their victim's eyes. For the majority, it will just be the low-level numbing and gnawing sadness that they uttered unkind words or did unkind things or failed to do kind things. For the Hitlers of this world, they will feel keenly and graphically the torment of those they tortured, the sheer anguish and pain of those having family members torn from them. And so it goes on. So you end up by saying that you really think that Rethinking Hell has got Daniel 12:2 wrong. I don't think it points to annihilationism at all. And you also make important points about the fact that for anyone for whom that idea of that hell that you paint there, Ray, is one that they don't like, well, that Christ has made away from it. The above explanation helps us to understand the immensity, depth and cost of the statement. As far as the East is from the West, so far has he removed our transgression from us. OK, thank you very much. Let's talk about other programmes and specifically last week's, where we had Stephen Law, atheist philosopher, and Angus Ritchie, who has helped to write a report for Theos on why humanists need God. Steve Pond says, another very good discussion today as I made my way round Waitrose doing the big shop. Angus and Stephen certainly made their points well and allowed time for each other. Thank you for the moderation. Angus's main point is, of course, that principles of humanism have firm foundations when built on Christianity, and Stephen questioned that. I'd be interested in another show, taking it further, and see how Angus ties the matter of human dignity, etc., with the evolution of man. If humanism has a firm foundation on Christianity, let's just take one further step back and ask, what foundation does Christianity have on the evolution of our species on the African plains all those years ago? We don't, in our history, as far as I'm aware, find a Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve, first human child that's in the image of God, where its parents are not. So if I accept what Angus wants me to, I am then accepting something that actually has no basis of truth in the history of our species. So that's what you wanted to point out, Steve. You finish your email saying, I finished the show with a complete misquote of John F. Kennedy ringing in my ears. We choose to go down the path of humanism, not because it is easy, but because it is hard. It is a challenge we are willing to accept and not postpone for another day. May I add that, of course, taking the Christian approach also can bring its difficulties. Humanism has no sole claim to such things. Arnold in Toronto, I promised to read Arnold's email. He said, well, you got me again, fuming to respond. Good work. Why are your guests talking about a man in a coma and whether his life is worth the life of a monkey? My God, what a boring static example. How about how many animal lives is a human life worth? Does the kind of animal matter? What if the animal is going extinct? Does it always tilt in the person's favour? This question is the main reason I rejected Christianity. It's a horrible thing to walk around on the planet thinking you are sacred and everything is here for the pickings. It's deeply unwise and narcissistic and explains a lot about the condition of the world. Well, if that's the reason you rejected Christianity, Arnold, I have to say I just have a completely different conception of, yes, I do believe humans have a inherent unique value being made in the image of God. I don't think in any way that means that everything is here for the pickings, as you put it. I think the Bible very clearly speaks against that in Genesis anyway. But there you go. Thank you for getting in touch. Just quickly then, some comments that came in underneath the show. You can find it online and add yours as well. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable to add your comments to last week's programme. Maddie Guru Bai says, I really appreciated the argument provided by Angus and which Stephen basically concurred on. It seems that the atheist humanists need to rewrite their doctrinal statements or to offer an exposition which clearly insists there is nothing special about humans other than by virtue of the summation of their capacities, at least the ones in Amsterdam and their chums do. I'm not at all sure why man being created in the image of God is inconsistent with a view of capacities, though. The discussion didn't get into that. I mean, does the Christian position require us to say humans are special because of their species boundary? Why? When we argue about what it means to be made in the image of God, then why shouldn't that include capacities? Indeed, it often does when I've heard it discussed. God is love, God is moral, God is creative. Christians often pick up on these and argue that that is why humans love, are moral, and are creative. Maybe Christianity and atheism can diverge so far on this point we can actually find they meet round the back of the issue. I've always thought atheist humanist precepts and doctrines, whatever they're called, are rather arbitrary, but it was very surreal to see them attacked by an academic atheist like Stephen Law. Full marks to Theos for helping the humanists work things through. Then you had a bit of a conversation with one of our other contributors on the site as well, which was interesting to see. Here's another one who wanted to give their point of view. Did Stephen Law actually read Angus's paper before showing up? He basically agreed with both points on human dignity and human reason and spent the rest of the show wittering about why he doesn't like theism. Fair enough, Stephen, we get that. But it does feel like the guys at Theos are helping atheist humanists with their thinking here. Most notably, the broad church of atheism seems to disagree within itself what are the very foundational tenets of so-called atheist humanism. Anyway, thank you very much for all of those thoughts and your responses to last week's programme. And so just as we close out, just time to tell you what's coming up on the programme next week, if you're able to tune in. If you're staying here on Premier Christian Radio, though, coming up next is The Profile. Maria Rodriguez is joined by two fantastic women, Marilyn Skinner and Christy Wimber. But if you're joining me next week at the same time or via podcast, here's what's coming up for you.
You're unbelievable.
It's round two, essentially, of today's discussion, as I'm joined again by John Loftus and David Marshall. We're going to be looking further into David Marshall's book on why Jesus passes the outsider test for faith. So join us again for that same time next week here on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable. In the meantime, have a great week.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.